Yep, Michael Sloan is standing by, so let's go ahead and give him a ring.
Who's my idol? Because he does what I want to do. I do interviews and articles, but I'd like to write for TV. Hey, Ven, take some notes here. He can help you out.
All right, here we go.
Calling Canada, eh?
Eh?
Hello.
Hi, is this Michael Sloan?
Yes.
Hi, Michael. You're on the air with Terry and Tiffany on Cult Radio Live. How are you?
Good. You guys, how are you doing?
Good, good.
I want to tell you, Michael, you've got to be my idol because I consider myself a writer because I do interviews and articles, but to write for TV and movies, I mean, that's, man.
Well, I seem to have been doing it for a long time, and it's been, you know, it's been really fun.
The one question I've always wondered about what you do, a lot of the series that you wrote for, of course, you came in later after it was already established. You did a lot of the return ofs or whatever. How do you write for a show that's already been going? I mean, are you one that would have had to have watched the series, or did they give you old scripts? Or how do you get into the story and the characters not having started from the beginning?
Well, not all of the shows that I did were ones I hadn't, you know, that I was just handed. For example, I was part of a show called McCloud that was at Universal. I produced the last season. Yeah. And then some years later, I decided it would be really fun to bring that character back. So that I initiated on my own. The Bionic movies were, those weren't my idea. I was at Universal and they came to me and said, you know, we want to do a return movie of The $6 Million Man and Bionic Woman. Would you be interested? I said, oh, yeah. And so I did watch some $6 Million Man and some Bionic Woman episodes to kind of get myself into it.
Yeah, those were the days back when Universal was doing television, good television anymore. I won't say it's quite so good. But.
Well, when I first got to Universal, which was in 1976, gulp, gasp, they had 16 one-hour dramas on the air. Dramas and action shows. And I mean, in those days, they were a real factory, and they really cranked them out, and they were really good, a lot of them. And I worked with a guy named Glenn Larson for a long time, for the first 5 years I was at Universal, and we did a lot of fun, shows together.
I think they were like the first movie studio to recognize that television was viable, or you know, if I'm not mistaken.
I think they were. They got very smart about doing TV and turning the studio over, and that and the tour.
Mm-hmm. Now, you actually kind of come from a showbiz family, because am I correct in knowing that your mom and dad were actually theatrical producers?
They were. They were producers on Broadway in the 40s and the 50s, and my cousin was a character actor you may recall named Keenan Wynn.
Really?
Yeah. And then I had another cousin who was, you remember the series Gunsmoke?
Yes.
My cousin was Milburn Stone, who played the old doctor.
I'll be doggone.
Yeah. So, and my sister Judy, she's an entertainment journalist in Los Angeles. So, yeah, you know, I do come from that, sort of theatrical and showbiz background. There was never any doubt as to what I would try to do with my life to a certain extent, because I was just born into that milieu, you know.
Well, we're hoping some of your family's listening tonight. You can say hi to them.
Well, I'll say hi to my sister Judy.
Fantastic. So I've got to ask. McCloud was like one of my favorites. You said you're a producer. It's all according, like a producer, a lot of times is on the set, sometimes they're not. Were you on the set a lot, and what kind of a guy was Dennis Weaver, if you really got to meet him much and talk to him?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was on the set a lot. I'm a very hands-on producer. The problem when you're doing a series, not so much McCloud, because McCloud, we did them, you know, they were six, 2 hours that we did a season. So that's a little different than doing an hour show. The problem with doing an hour show, if you're a creative producer like me, is that I'm also involved in the writing and the editing and the casting. And so I can't be on the set quite as much as I would like. Mm-hmm. But I was able to spend more time on McCloud. McCloud was the first show that I did when I came to Universal Studios in 1976. And Dennis Weaver was just, he was a wonderful, wonderful guy to write for and to be around. He was a very charming, funny, gentle guy. He was a minister as well. And not a lot of people know that. excuse me, it was funny. I remember writing the first McLeod script, and I thought, God, am I going to be able to get the humor of this and catch this guy's character? And I remember I wrote the very first scene. It was called Bonnie and McLeod, and he drops his girlfriend off at a hotel in a cab, and he gets out, and the cab driver says, "That'll be $20. And McLeod sort of reacts and pays, and the cab driver says, "This is a rough area. You want me to wait?" And McLeod says, "Be cheaper getting mugged."
And you did his voice really well, too. You sounded like
him. Oh, yeah, I could do Dennis pretty well. So Glenn Larson read that first scene. He said, "Okay, if that's the first joke you're writing from McLeod, I think you can write from McLeod." So I felt really good about that. Yeah, I don't remember every line of every script I've ever written, trust me. But I did remember that first McLeod line I wrote.
He sure did. Sure did a great film for Universal. He did Duel, that Steven Spielberg was involved in. That was a great performance.
Yeah, he loved that movie, and he loved working with Spielberg. And no one knew at the time, of course, what Steven Spielberg was going to become. But Dennis really knew that he was a terrific talent, and really enjoyed doing that movie with him.
So, what would you tell people like me that do interviews and articles that wants to become a screenwriter? How do you get into it?
Well, you know, it's hard. It's a lot harder now than when I first started. I mean, I think the one thing that a writer has got over a producer or even a director is that nobody can stop you from writing. I mean, you can sit there and stare at your blank computer screen, and it's awful. But you can actually go and write something down. I mean, the very first thing I ever wrote, I wrote an episode of Columbo. And I'll tell you the capsulized version, otherwise this will turn into a miniseries. But I was living in London, England, and I came up with this great idea for Columbo, and I was in my 20s, I guess. And it was about a magician. And I wrote up the story, and I happened to be visiting in Los Angeles, and I somehow managed to get the story in to a guy named Peter Fisher, who later created Murder, She Wrote. And he was the story editor on Columbo. And no one represented me. They called me in. They said, "Who are you?" I said, "Oh, you know, I'm from London." And they said, "Well, you know, this story is good, but this doesn't work. This doesn't work. Change these things." I went, "Okay, great." So I went away, and I came back the next day. And Peter said, "You know, you didn't have to do it like immediately." And I said, "Oh no, I did, because I'm leaving. I have to go back to London." Mm-hmm. And so I wrote the story out, and then they said, "Well, you know, this is pretty good. Do you want to write the screenplay, the teleplay?" And I said, "No, I'm sorry, I can't. I have to go back to London." And then they said, "You sure you couldn't do this? Like, make it, you know, this kind of a special occasion?" And I said, No. I've got to go back." And then they called me from Universal a week later and said, "Well, write the teleplay in London, and that's okay." So when I came I came back to the States. I'm an American, but when I came back to the States, I had at least one credit, but it was a really good credit, mm-hmm. and that credit, you know, opened some doors. So I guess the answer to your question is, you know, just, you know, take a look at whatever genre that's really interests you, and if you've got some good ideas, just try and sit down and think about it and work it out, get a shape for yourself, and then, you know, get a story around it, and then just go for it. You know?
Well, one of our listeners is a very good aspiring writer, and he gets really frustrated because they tell him you need an agent, yet you can't get an agent if you don't have a credit. So
it is a vicious circle. It is quite difficult. And, you know, some agents will read unsolicited material, but very few. I mean, even when I go back 30 years to that Columbo story, I mean, I wrote this story and no agent would read it. It was just because I gave it to an agent who was a friend of a friend, who said, "You know, I'll read this and send it in." We never bothered to read it, but he did send it in. Mm-hmm. I guess the problem 30 years on is that it is tough to get an agent to read something, and most studios really need you to have some kind of representation. because they're, you know, afraid of getting sued.
Right.
It is difficult, but the only thing I would say that is, you know, agents like everyone else, they go to work and they've got all their deals and they've got all their hundreds of phone calls they make, but if something comes across their desk and they actually read it and it's terrific, you know what? They'll pick up a phone and call you.
Right.
Say, come on, we'd like to, you know, we'd like to talk about this. It's not unheard of, even in the cutthroat business as it is today.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, for those that don't know, Michael, I mean, people are pretty common in knowing that back in the day, that actors, unlike today, used to be under contract to studios.
Right.
And you had mentioned when you joined Universal in the 70s. Now, did they kind of deal with writers the same way? Were you under contract with Universal to where you would just work on various Universal projects? Or was it just kind of whatever you got picked up for at the time?
No, yeah. I was under what they used to call an overall deal, which they don't do anymore. And that was I got to the studio specifically to do McCloud. But I had an overall deal. I think it was 2 years initially, and then it got extended for another 3. And so once I'd finished McCloud, then I went on to other shows. And I did have a contract as a writer-producer.
Well, you certainly did good work because, well, you can be proud of the fact that you're Mr. and Mrs. Emmy nominated, because, of course, your wonderful wife was nominated for an Emmy, but you were also nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Drama Series for Quincy, which was a great show.
I was. We didn't win, sadly. We lost to the Rockford Files, but that's okay.
God bless Jack Klugman. He was a great man, lovely man.
Yeah, he's a terrific guy. And yeah. He was very, and it's really, you know, Quincy was kind of the forerunner of all the CSI shows now. It was the first, you know, first show to deal with forensic science, and so it was kind of a forerunner of this, you know, explosion of really great ensemble television that they're writing and producing now.
Well, there's always that question: how do you write about something you don't do, or how do you write about something you don't know? For instance, like you talked about, Quincy was a medical examiner, basically a coroner, and I'm sure. You weren't, so did you talk to coroners or whatever? How did you get the niche to write that?
We spent time with Noguchi, who was the coroner of Los Angeles at the time. And, yeah, we talked to him and to some of his guys. And, I mean, in those days you didn't have the Internet. I mean, now research is a lot simpler. If you want to know something, you just Google it.
Yeah, that's great.
But in those days you really had to kind of go down and talk to the real folks, and that was kind of good. I always liked that. But no, contrary to popular belief, I knew nothing about being a coroner, so we would talk to experts.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of a stretch, too. I mean, it was very brave of Jack to do that. Of course, he's a great dramatic actor, was in Twilight Zone and everything, but I mean, coming from The Odd Couple.
It was very difficult for Jack, because he was used to The Odd Couple. He was used to having a script, sitting around with all the producers and the other actors and changing it at table readings and changing it again and changing it right before they do a performance. Whereas in, you know, dramatic episodic television, he couldn't do that. I mean, you're given the script and that's what you shoot. It's not that you can't change things as you're going along.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he found it a difficult process to, you know, to change his way of thinking. But he did a very good job, and you know the show was a real success.
Well, what about actors that don't like lines? I got a chance to act in a couple episodes of The Gilmore Girls, and I won't name the actors, but they didn't like the lines, and they were trying to change the lines right then and there, and the writer was ticked off. I mean, did that ever happen to you?
Well, it happens occasionally. When I tell you a quick story. I did this show called Kung Fu, The Legend Continues with the late David Carradine, bless his heart. And I remember after I shot the series in Toronto, Canada, and there was a 2-hour opener called Initiation, and there was a character of a bad guy. And now I was doing all the casting sessions because that's what I always did.
Mm-hmm.
And so this really fantastic Asian actor came in, played one of the bad guys in. Really nice guy. We're talking, and I always try and put actors at ease because it's, you know, a very tough profession. And anyway, he's got his sides in his hand, and he says, "So, Michael, do you mind if I paraphrase this? Because you know, I'm not saying this." this sucks, you know. And I said, no, go ahead, sure. Yeah. So he paraphrased the scene and did a good job, you know, get the end of the scene. Now all the color has drained out of the casting director's face. Mm-hmm. And he gets to the end of the scene, he said, well, thanks a lot, Vaughn, his name was Vaughn Flores. And mm-hmm. he said, I hope you didn't mind my paraphrasing, because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say this.
Right.
And I said, no, that's fine. And so later on, the casting director saw him at a party that night and said, I guess you didn't realize that the executive producer of Kung Fu also wrote the script. And he was, like, mortified. And he got the part. I mean, I gave him the part. He was mm-hmm. great. And so on the very first day of shooting of first episode of Kung Fu, we're down in Chinatown in Toronto, and there's Vaughn standing with David Carradine, and I walked over to him, and he's, like, looking nervously around, and I just put an arm around his shoulder, and I said, hey, Vaughn, I'm having a lot of trouble with this next scene. I wonder if you could help me out here, you know. And he just wanted the pavement to open up and swallow him. So,
wow.
So I did get back at him, but...
Well, you've got a good way.
Happened to me.
You got a good way of dealing with actors. I guess that comes from the fact that you did some acting yourself, right? I mean, you know what it's like.
Well, sort of. I mean, if you could put it that way. I mean, yes, in my meteorically unsuccessful career as an actor, I did a few things when I was young, but it was never something that I really wanted to do.
Yeah.
I'd always been writing from like a young age, and it always felt that, you know, writing and then, you know, you kind of get into producing to try and, to a certain extent, particularly in older days, to kind of protect your work, you know.
Right.
So I was never going to have a big acting career. In fact, the last time I ever acted, I directed a play. I directed Wait Until Dark at a local theater in Burbank about 20 years ago, and there's one role in it of the husband who says goodbye to the blind girl. He's got a big scene in the first act, and you never see him again for the entire play, and he comes back at the end and says, oh, my God, are you okay, honey? And we, you know, this is Equity Waiver Theater, so mm-hmm. we had an actor doing it, and we opened, like, a good reviews and was running for about 2 weeks, and then this actor split. He got a job in San Francisco, and we couldn't get anyone to do the role because it was such a, you know, not a very nice, good role. So in the end, I went, all right, well, I'll do it then. I mean, we weren't getting paid anything.
Right.
So I did like 20 or 30 performances of this, you know, big scene in the beginning and come out at the end saying, honey, you okay? And that was about the last time anyone saw me thespian.
Without giving actual figures, I wouldn't do that to you. When you work as a writer for television or for movies, can they become as comfortable as an actor? I mean, is the pay really good, or is it like half of what an actor gets, or...?
Well, it depends, you know. I mean, salaries for writers have gone up over the years, but not exponentially as they have for actors, you know. I mean, actors in series years ago don't make anywhere near what they make now.
Right.
And, you know, writing for payment for writers is in television is extremely good, and with residuals and stuff. But you're not going to get your mansion in Barbados writing television, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think about the, I think it was like a protest they did. They were boycotting the Screen Writers Guild down here because of the new digital thing, because they weren't getting paid for stuff being shown on the Internet or for DVDs and stuff. What do you think about that?
Well, I thought, yeah. I mean, I think they were extreme, you know, they were very right. I mean, now you can run, you know, you can run whole episodes on the Internet and not have to pay for them. And so there was just, no one knew what to do with this new technology. There had never been any guidelines mapped out. So I think, you know, I mean, it was a pretty crippling strike, but I think certainly the reason that the writers, you know, demanded to have some kind of a representation in digital was extremely right.
Right. Definitely, I agree. I've got to ask you. You said you usually go on set and you try to be hands on as much as possible. We were really crushed here at Cult Radio because we love all the cult legends way into movies when David Carradine passed away. Do you have any stories?
Stories about David?
Yes.
That I can tell you on the air.
Actually, you can say anything on here on this station.
Anything on your show. David was a really charming, wonderful guy, and he was full of life, full of stories. He he could snap in and out of that Huai Chang Kang character. He knew it. He knew it so well. It was not a walk in the park, you know. But he was very prepared, and he loved the character, he loved the crew, he loved the actors he worked with. And when he got his star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, he called me and asked me if I would give it to him, because he felt that because of Kung Fu, The Legend Continues and Kill Bill, those two things were what turned his career around, he felt, at the time. So he asked, I guess he couldn't get Quentin, so he asked me. So I gave him the star, and one of the things I said into the mic with the people there, I said, I remember that we used to call him Sparky, because he was kind of lively and fun. And I said, you know, and his brothers were there, Bobby and Keith. And I said, so you'd hear over the 80s speakers, they'd say, okay, let's get Sparky traveling. Okay, Sparky's needed on set. And then invariably there'd be a long pause. Okay, so has anybody seen Sparky? Does anybody have a 20 on Sparky at all? And I mean, I remember looking over and Keith Carradine is like on the floor in hysterics and Bobby's just shaking his head. So, you know, David was fun to work with. I mean, I've done 11 series over the years, some of them fairly long running, and really, Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, it was kind of the most fun I had doing. We did four seasons of that, 88 episodes, and it was a really great show.
Well, you seem to be a laid-back kind of guy, and definitely somebody I could see that Melissa would fall in love with, because you're easy to get along with. But I don't know if you get nervous, but to take on doing Hitchcock, Hitchcock was so known for the style of the shows that he had, and that, did that bother you at all? Or?
Well, yeah, it was kind of daunting. I remember Richard Lindheim, who's a good friend of mine, was an executive at Universal at the time, said, we've done 39 half hours in color, but we're gonna do another 41, but they want, the network wants, you know, sort of a new guy to take it over, and would you consider it? And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. So the caveat that I made is the first 39 that were done were all, they just rewrote the old scripts, and I felt the problem with that is audiences are much more sophisticated now. Right. This we're talking now, 20 years ago. So I said, I think you need to have more than one twist at the end of the stories. You have to have, you know, a single twist and a double twist and a triple twist. And then just when you thought it was safe to turn the television off, give them another one. Mm-hmm. So it was daunting, but I only wanted to do it if we could write original scripts within those Hitchcock guidelines. So, once that was approved, then it was really fun to do. And, they were challenging because you did have something pretty big to live up to. But, it was like making a little, 25 minute movie every week. And, it was challenging, but it was fun.
Well, you mentioned guidelines. I guess you were probably just making a metaphor, but what was there actually a guideline that Universal said you got to do this or this to be like Hitchcock, or did you just go on your own knowledge?
No, it was more that, like I said, Hitchcock, vintage Hitchcocks have a big twist at the end, and what I proposed to do in the ones that that I was involved in on my watch were to have a single twist and then maybe a double twist and then just when you thought it was okay, twist it again. So, but those were the guidelines were, it had to have suspense and it had to have twists and turns in it. And that, those are the guidelines that we tried to build on.
Well, let me ask you this, because we, try to go loosely off of it, because the Internet Movie Database is sometimes so incorrect, but in the mid-80s you worked on the television show The Equalizer, and then
yes.
IMDb has it listed that there is a new Equalizer project in development. Is that true?
That is absolutely true, yes. I created The Equalizer with Richard Lindheim, and I do have, there is a feature being developed that I'm developing with Mace Neufeld, who did Hunt for Red October, and he's just finishing off Mandela. and with Harvey Weinstein.
Fantastic! I love that show.
Yeah, it was a great show, and I was very pleased that I was able to get Edward Woodward to play the lead in that show, because he was a very atypical television hero, particularly in those days, you know.
Well, with you involved, we look forward to it being true to the original, because, you know, the ones that come out now, the movies, they just so rape what it was, you know.
Well, hopefully that's not going to happen. I mean, I do know Robert McCall pretty well, and so we're trying to keep to the spirit of the series, but obviously, you know, make it fresh and new, and make it bigger for a big feature audience. But yes, that is absolutely in the works.
Well, in talking about how they kind of will do rehashings or remakes, if you will, you had actually worked on a couple episodes of Battlestar Galactica, and then of course there's the brand new series that just came out. Have you seen the new series? How do you kind of feel about it versus the one that you worked on?
Well, I think the new series was fantastic. I mean, it was some of the best writing and acting on television, I think, and the best special effects that I've seen. Battlestar Galactica and the new Doctor Who, those are the two best special science fiction effects you're going to see on television.
Mm-hmm.
And as to how it, you know, the original was a little more charming, a little bit more westernish. Yeah, I was involved. I wrote several of the episodes, and I was involved in producing them for like the first 10, and then I went on to a highly esoteric series called BJ and the Bear. So, I remember I was doing I was writing producing the last season of Outer Limits in Vancouver, and the makeup girl came on, the wardrobe girl came on with a Battlestar Galactica jacket. And she had worked on the first season of Battlestar Galactica. And I said, oh, wow, I was involved in the original. And she suddenly started bowing and saying, oh, my God, we are not worthy.
Well, I don't want to embarrass you, Michael. That's the way we feel about you. Because you wrote such great classics. Yeah, I laugh when you mentioned BJ and the Bear, because I remember hearing the story. It was Greg Evigan, right? That was
That's correct.
Yeah, and I heard he had trouble with the monkey, and he just took the clipboard and just slapped the monkey one day, and the monkey behaved from then on. Did you hear about that?
That I think is an apocryphal story. The monkey actually took the clipboard and smacked him.
Oh, okay. Yes, as they will do.
No, the monkey's name was Sam in real life, and he and Sam were great pals.
Wow.
Great pals. And, I doubt that story has any truth to it.
Well, to me, that's a definite classic. You did one that kind of is slated as the worst TV show ever made. It was Baywatch Nights.
Well, I wrote an episode of Baywatch Nights. I don't know that you could lay all of that blame at my doorstep.
We'll but, just say your episode was probably better than the others.
You were moonlighting.
not necessarily at all. But,
what do you think of that whole concept that they did when they changed it from Baywatch to Baywatch Nights?
Well, I don't know, because I never really watched Baywatch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be hard for me. I didn't watch Baywatch Nights either. In fact, I've never seen the episode I wrote. So I would not be a good judge to answer that question.
Yeah, I was really excited when they came out with the Outer Limits. I call it the new Outer Limits. I'm old. I remember the old ones, you know, the black and whites and everything. But I actually did an article for a national magazine when it came out, and I thought it was pretty true to the original. What do you think?
Oh, I thought they were very much in the spirit of the original, and they did seven seasons. I was on the last season, mm-hmm. and the scripts were really good, and they got terrific actors. And again, they made those Outer Limits like little half hour movies, and a lot of care went into it, and a lot of they were the guys that ran that show, Penn Densham and Mark Stern, they were very careful to put a lot of humanity into the shows. It wasn't just a sci-fi show. It wasn't
right.
just a fantasy show.
Yeah, the original was more kind of monsters and sci-fi. I mean, it didn't go as much into like what you're talking there with.
No, Outer Limits was a very character-driven show. I mean, that's what they did with, that's how they were so smart, I think, with Battlestar Galactica, is that they, what, with the advent of all the fantastic special effects you can see in features, and they were doing that, but they knew that, it seems to me, that what they needed to focus on was the character and the humanity of this ragtag fleet tried to find Earth, and they just brilliantly succeeded, I think.
Well, you did a couple of things with the Bionic Woman and $6 Million Man, right?
Yes, I did three. I did the three Return movies.
Those are great. They should do another one. They should do the because you know God knows they still look good.
Well, you know, it would be fun. I tried a couple of times with Richard Anderson, who was in the show. Mm-hmm. You know, to do another one, but part of the problem is so few networks do TV movies anymore.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's very hard to develop a 2-hour TV movie, you know, in this day and age. I mean, there's a couple of networks that really still do them. The Hallmark Channel do them and Lifetime do them, but you know, there aren't that many networks who really do a whole ton of TV movies anymore. But you know, as you said, I've done some of these Return movies, which are really fun. The most fun one I did was there was a show called The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and you guys are cult radio guys.
Definitely.
You know, that's fun. And so I did The Return of The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and that was really fun to do.
That show was great because of the relationship between them and the humor. It had a great humor to it.
Yeah, oh no, it did. And the two guys were good friends, and it was fun to bring them back together again. And then, of course, my friend David McCallum, he's really a good friend of mine, and he's now, of course, in NCIS. And it's funny, I mean, for wherever he went, it was always, Ilya, how are you doing? He lives in New York, and he was always Ilya Kuryakin, and he always said to me on my tombstone, it'll be Ilya Kuryakin lies here, sometimes known as David McCallum. But he said now, when he walks down, you know, Fifth Avenue, people don't do that anymore. They say, "Hey, Ducky, how are you?" So he's finally laid Ilya Kuryakin to rest.
Right. Well, let me ask you, because I mean, you've kind of run the gamut. You've done suspense writing, you've done action and adventure, you've done humor. Is there a certain genre that is more your forte that you love more, or is it kind of just any and all spectrum?
You can't really say you're typecast. You do all kinds of different ones.
Well, there are some that I would not shine in. It's more thriller stuff. You know, thriller and action adventure and drama. I would be pretty lame trying to, you know, write a sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that well. And as mildly amusing as I can be from time to time, I don't really think I'd be very good at writing rom-coms, as I'm told they're called, romantic comedies. So I'm more of a thriller writer.
You ever write books? I mean, I know you do the scripts, but what about mystery novels and film?
Well, I haven't. I over a period of time, I wrote a whole bunch of children's novels for my daughter Piper growing up, and I've never tried to get them published, but now I've been encouraged to try and get them out there. So I have got those, and there's a couple of book ideas that I'm developing. And if The Equalizer is made as a big feature, I own the book rights, and so it would be fun to, you know, for me to write, you know, some books based on the character, which I think a public would really enjoy.
Well, now you live in Canada, you have the opportunity because it's all peaceful out there, and spread out, and all that, because you'd be more relaxed instead of living here in crazy Hollywood.
Well, you know, I lived in Los Angeles for 27 years, so, you know, I got used to the pace, and I come back all the time for business meetings and, you know, and stuff like that, so, you know, I'm never too far away from Hollywood.
Now, a lot of our listeners want to, of course, know how you ended up meeting Melissa and how you guys met and kind of got together. Was it actually on a project that you guys were working on together?
It was. she was, when we did these 41 new episodes of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents, the caveat from USA Network was, you know, you can have as many Canadian actors in it, really terrific actors, but there has to be an American guest star in every show, an American TV guest, you know, with TVQ. And so Melissa was the guest star on the very first Hitchcock episode that I wrote and produced, and that's how we met.
Wow. And the other thing that we wanted to find out is also, again, on IMDb, listed in development is a project called Claws. Now, what is that about?
Claws is a horror script that Chuck Freese, who's he's a real legend. I appreciated your publicity calling me legendary. Chuck Freese is really legendary. Wonderful guy. And he's had a script for some years that I did a big rewrite on called Claws. That it's a great premise. It's basically like Hitchcock's Birds, only it's with cats.
Oh. I'm sure you heard our studio cat a few minutes ago. That's a good movie because yes, cats will attach themselves to your backside if you don't be careful.
Oh yeah, well it's a good little horror script, and it takes place on an island, and you got to be careful how you shoot these things, because I mean the trick of it is to not make it comedic,
uh-huh.
and it would take a very clever director and a major cat wrangler. But there was I forget what year it was in. I think it was in season four. There was a really terrific X-Files, and it was about a big cat. It was about a cougar or something. But they had a sequence in a warehouse. I only saw this recently. I hadn't seen it when I wrote the script. Mm-hmm. But they had a sequence in a warehouse with Mulder and Scully where these like 100 cats are like completely diseased and trying to attack them, and it was really a brilliant little sequence. And I thought, oh, good, this can work. And you just got to do it in short spurts to make it work. But it's a fun script. It hasn't sold yet, but I'm hoping it's going to.
Well, definitely. Do you ever struggle with that as far as, you know, watching TV or film, and of course being a writer, you're kind of like a creative sponge, and maybe getting an idea of something that you liked and saw on the screen, and then just not even thinking about it having that kind of influence your writing or come out in what you're doing?
Are you asking me if I plagiarize easily?
I guess that's a way of putting it.
I think all writers are influenced by what they see and what they read and what they hear. I don't make a habit of seeing something and go, oh, that's good, I think I'll rip that off. But it depends on your phraseology. I mean, when I was doing Kung Fu, The Legend Continues, we did a lot of what I would call valentines to old movies. I mean, we did The Magnificent Seven, and we did The Great Escape, and we did Key Largo.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think all writers are influenced, by what they see and what they read and what they assimilate. Sure.
Everybody likes to say now that Hollywood has run out of ideas, and that's why they keep doing what they're doing. Do you think that is, or do you think it's always been that way, to where they kind of copied things that were before?
Well, I don't. I think I think that's kind of trite to say that. I mean, ideas are ideas, you know, and there's hundreds of them, and they're always going to be there and turning over. I think that if something's successful, it's so difficult to get a success and to latch on to something that if it's worked, I think there's a thought, particularly in Hollywood, to use a generic term, where, all right, well, that's worked and that generated money and that was a crowd pleaser, let's try and do it again in a slightly different way. People latch on to things that are successful. I mean, you get a new TV show that's a little different, and then there's like four or five pilots, or, you know, all like the same show. I mean, I can't tell you how many Equalizer ripoffs have been, shot over the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it can happen.
Did you ever worry about having to do the same thing over? Because I know Hollywood, like, if you're successful in some, Rob Zombie did a remake of Halloween. He's going to be doing them forever, and they're going to keep making him do those? Are you worried they're going to keep making you do the same thing all the time?
No, I'd be happy to have all these offers flood in for me to do the same thing.
There you go, there you go.
That would, have your more influential listeners get in touch with me.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being on the show, Michael. It was a definite joy, and we know you're humble, but we do here at Cult Radio consider you a legend.
Well, you're delusional, but it's very nice.
Well, you think about it this way. I mean, I love actors and everything. But a lot of times we handed lines to actors to do for the radio show here or to do a station ID, you know, other actors, especially guys, and they really mumble and stumble. So if they don't have that script, they're not as charming and witty. So it's you people that make the actors look good.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Thanks.
Well, once again, like I said, we wanted to thank you for being on the show, and keep in touch. If the Equalizer project gets off the ground or if Claws gets picked up, let us know. Maybe we'll have you come back on. We can do an update.
That would be great. I'll be sure to do that, and I hope your show continues to go very well, and that you keep old writers like me alive in people's minds. I think that's highly laudable.
Yeah.
I've got to ask you, being married to Melissa, do you live on a prairie?
I don't live in the prairie. I live in the city of Montreal. I know that's a crushing admission, but I am not currently living on the prairie.
Okay, excuse me for my corniness. I just had to say that. It's just been dogging me on that. We look forward to having your lovely wife on next week.
Okay, that's great. Well, thanks for calling me so much, you guys.
No problem. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.